It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited
by law. See terms and conditions 18+. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Here at William Hill, you'll find pre-game and in-play cricket odds on loads of competitions. From test matches to one-day internationals, T20s and domestic cricket, we've got everything covered. Visit williamhill.com, 18+. Please gamble responsibly. William Hill, it's who you play with.
Season 4 of Middle Peas Umpire is sponsored by Step One.
Hello everyone and welcome to this episode of Middle Peas Umpire. I'm Miles Jupp and I tell funny jokes. Ha ha ha.
My name is Mark Wood and I've lengthened my run up. and I'm as ever nursing some sort of injury.
What have you been up to, Mark?
I've been picking blackberries. I've been watching Jason and the Argonauts.
That is a classic. I'm not surprised you should have that on repeat, Mark. Let's check the mailbag. This is actually how I thought, you and your, for people listening, I thought that Miles and his family, when we did the podcast in Monmouth, Miles was very kindly put me and the producer up at his house. And this is how I thought you all would be together. I thought you would speak in form of theatrical song together.
Really?
Yeah.
Despite the fact that I've never been in a musical?
No, but I just thought that side of you would come out and that you'd be ready for any part to jump into any sort of arena.
I think if we had more...
It's like 2020 in one day. You can go across all formats. That's what I thought.
I think if we had more leisure time, we probably would do a lot more sort of singing as a family. But basically, we're so busy working on the looms that it's not really possible.
Do you know what I was really impressed with? The amount of Lego you had in your house.
Lego, yeah. Well, it's just the greatest toy, isn't it, Lego?
Have you ever built a cricket wicket with your Lego?
No. And even though green is the most popular colour, is it, for the sort of the big flat square pieces?
Because that's basically what they... Remember them Flicks pitches? You remember them? Like, at all the club grounds, everyone would have a Flicks pitch and stuff like that. It was like basically they looked like Legos stuck together and they made, like, a hard wicket for you to practice on so you didn't have to...
Oh, I assumed you meant, like, a little game. Because I thought you meant something like Test Match, which I have.
Yeah.
I've got a version... I mean, it must be from... I got given a new version as a present when I left the news quiz, which actually was endorsed. It's endorsed by Michael Atherton. I think that's why they got it for me. But I had one in the 80s that had Botham and a friend of the show, the notorious D.I.G.
He's got love in the 80s.
I'm glad to see that you're free associating so confidently, Mark. Do you feel that all of the meds have worn off? have you fallen over this week?
No, I don't think I have.
I did fall over. I fell over in Manchester. I fell over on my way into a pub, which is the wrong way round. I'd had nothing to drink, but I had a thing where I missed. It was slightly embarrassing, really. They'd obviously extended the curb, but they'd done that thing when they sort of build a new curb, fill in the gap with sort of tarmac, but left the old curb there. but the old curb to me seemed sort of more prominent, so I thought I was about a metre and a half away from the curb and then walked bang slap into the new one.
Ooh.
And went flying, landed on my knees, my hands. I landed, I was quite lucky, I fell between two pub benches. But the people I was with were very protective, so they picked me up and they went, have a sit down, just sit down, get yourself ready. And that I think made it look like it had been a more spectacular.
And did you say, tell Mike I love him or tell Athas I love him?
I said, guys, I'm fine, really, really, I'm fine. Honestly, I'm fine, please. And then I don't know why I did this, I turned to the people who I'd fallen over next to and said, I'm so sorry. absolutely ludicrous. Anyway, it's probably going to keep me out of action. I started All Stars, did my first All Stars session. Absolutely exhausting, but very worthwhile. Some very talented people there. I mean, the hard bit's setting up and learning the game. Have you ever done an All Stars? You must have.
No, I've done junior cricket coaching, but I'm not sure I've done an All Stars session. How is it different from a normal session?
Well, basically, because it's right at sort of entry level, so you get sent these drills. So these first ones, you know, this could be for someone that has never sort of played cricket before or whatever. So it's just like familiarising yourself with the kit, I suppose. So that me and another guy I know, we were actually in charge of batting, and it was almost like there was a sort of like a slalom course arranged, and it was just about their sort of skills, just being able to. It's about really getting bat on ball, I suppose, and getting used to that feel. I'd forgotten how knackering it was. And then you've got to take all the stuff down at the end, which is...
Did you use reinforced prayers? That's a part of the cricket coaching? Where you just don't say a good shot, you tell them why it was a good shot?
Oh, no. I need to reinforce, do I?
Yes, reinforce, always reinforce. Maybe ask questions why it was so good.
Gosh, so I say to them, that was really good. Why was it so good?
Yes, and then they would say, well, actually, I watched the ball right in my bat, and you say, you've got it in one.
I'd sort of panic and say something like, it was reminiscent of a young fill in the gap. Oh, you reminded me of Mark Wood facing Mitchell Stark or whatever. Or you reminded me of...
Did he get bald, did he?
you've had lots of very good days, Mark. You mustn't do down your batting. But I'm not alone in thinking that, I happen to know.
Do you know what I've never actually asked you? If you could play, say they're making a movie and it's of a cricket team, which cricketer or which role would you have to be?
Would I have to be?
Who would you audition for as?
Oh, probably some sort of blazer-wearing committee man that's continually sputtering, going, no, I'm so sorry. Cricket is not supposed to change, and I am sick of hearing the word progress being bandied around in these hallowed chambers and corridors. I will not have it. It's disgraceful. It is disgraceful. I'm sorry. No, our players travel to Australia by boat or nothing. And it would be that kind of thing. It's not like I could play a young anything, frankly. If you were cast in a remake of any film or television programme, Mark, who would you play? Professor Yaffle?
No, I think I'd gone.
Oh, I think you'd be quite a good D'Artagnan.
D'Artagnan, we're going to save the king.
Yes.
And then I know I'd come. Yeah, I can say it now.
Well, at Christmas, there was that really good Around the World in 80 Days that was on with David Tennant in. The only thing that I didn't like about it was the fact they didn't use the theme tune from 80 Days Around the World from when I was a kid. The, hey, now the story must go on, because you find a place to go, we must get ready to go. 80 Days Around the World, you find a place to go, you're sitting where the rainbows are. So I kept playing that. I got it off YouTube and kept playing it to my children, so they finally learned it. And I said, you just enjoy the programme, but you must have this music in your head at the beginning.
See, I knew you sung In the House. So all this, we don't do that. I knew you did it.
We don't do it when we've got guests. We just we get the Lego out. Because I remember because actually it was Rachel's idea. I said, oh gosh, no, look, we've got Mark Wood coming to stay, so we ought to, how should we do things? And we were like, should we make up a bed? And Rachel Wisey said, well, we should probably get some toys out for him. So that's why.
You know what we should talk about? How did you find the live show?
Doing this live, I absolutely loved it. I was quite nervous, to be honest, because I suddenly thought we've only done one when we're in the same room, which was the very first one with the Notorious D.I.G. And then we've not done any others in the same room anyway. And then there's the added sort of pressure of an audience. And I think even the audience were nervous. I think they relaxed.
You had the home crowd advantage, though.
You had the advantage of being the international cricketer, Mark Wood, who people were really excited to see. I really liked it. I mean, I just liked... It was nice to have a, what was like a proper cricket club event as well. It was that felt really, really fun.
They're great nights at your local clubs, though, aren't they, when you have people in and everyone comes down. And I remember some of my favourite memories at my cricket club were like that, where everyone would be together and would have a dinner or would have like a special night or a live band.
There's normally a keen barbecuist, isn't there? You know, to me, that's the bit. I mean, playing cricket's all very well, but sitting in a fold-out chair, drinking beer from a can and talking about cricket, to me, that's what it's really about, I have to say.
And did Monmouth win it the weekend? Because we did it on a Friday. Did they win on a Saturday?
They had an all right showing. I'd have to go back and check the WhatsApp group to get the exact results. But they had four teams out, so they'll have done all right.
Ashton have had a strong start of the season. They've lost one, but they've won the rest of their games, so... strong start.
And you played for them?
I played a game last year. I'm not allowed to play this year, I don't think, because they've got a Durham professional, a lad from Durham who's going to be that Durham player. So it doesn't look like that I might get the chance this year. But I would seriously love to. I still love playing for cricket.
You've been at Durham just training, I guess?
Yes, just I've had the England physios very kindly come up and see me a few times and make sure that, you know, I'm on track and things. And like a lot of injuries, it's never playing sailing on an upward curve back. You have some days where it feels a little bit ropey and then other days where it feels great. But as long as you can get over that little speed bump and you can start to feel free and stuff, it'll come back quick. So I'm in that sort of in-between phase at the minute where I'm building my bowling back up. I'm probably off half a run up now. So hopefully it keeps going in that direction.
What about things like fielding? If you're just working on your bowling and stuff like that, do you have to do a lot of fielding drills before you suddenly go back out there again? When you finally play a T20 game?
Yeah, well, I have to, because you've got to be up to speed. It's no good as getting me bowling up the scratch, but then I can't throw the ball in. So, but when you're getting back to fitness and you're happy with the rest of your, how the rest of you is doing or feeling, I mean, they keep England on particularly trying to work hard on my batting to improve that. So, might be a good chance to try that now. Well, I went the other day to the indoor centre, and my wife, my son, and my father-in-law all came with us. And my father-in-law fed me on the bowl machine. Obviously, I pulled the net out, and my son was watching from the net next door, like an open centre. So we pulled the end net out, and he was watching from the centre, and he went and grabbed his little plastic bat and was hitting the ball around. So that was nice to see that.
Now, shall we have a look at our mailbag now that we've described how injured you are and how injured I am? I seem to be... Rarely, I'm more injured than you at the moment. Right, OK. This is... I don't know if the producer or the people sending the letters give them titles. Our first letter is from Matthew Mason, and it's under the title First Game Embarrassment. First Game Embarrassment. By Matthew Mason. Hi, chaps. After hearing one of your listeners talking about playing with complete novices, I thought I'd tell you about my first club cricket experience. I hadn't played since school, but fancied the idea of a genteel game of cricket on a Saturday afternoon, so I got a game playing for Askham Bryan CC near York. I'd never played a proper club game before, so I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. I soon found myself in action. However, as batting first, we stumbled from 14 for 1 to 20 for 6. And it was my turn. Coming in at 8 might seem to be batting quite high for someone who's never held a bat before, but in true village style, we were 3 men short and needs must. I'd borrowed pads and a bat from a teammate, but as I was beginning to walk to the middle, someone thrust a thigh pad towards me. Thinking this must be an essential piece of equipment, I accepted it. Now, I hadn't seen this piece of kit before and was more than a little bit bemused by the long strap and wasn't completely sure what to do with it. Anyway, I tried to put it on as best as I could above my whites as I walked to take guard, whatever that was. Kelfield's wicketkeeper could clearly see he was dealing with a true professional here, and looking at the thigh pad strap tangled around the top of my leg told me it's supposed to go around your waist, not your bollocks. Amid a few sniggers, he very kindly adjusted it for me before I had a conflag with my batting partner. It's turning quite a bit, so make sure you get a good step in towards where it pitches, Michael told me. Sage words of advice for a novice, I'm sure you'll agree. I got ready to face my first ball. Get a good step in, get a good step in, I repeated in my mind. And sure enough, I did. However, as the ball span passed my outside edge into the wicketkeeper's gloves, I realised a key detail. He didn't mean my back foot. Seeing me a giant step outside my crease and in more of a tangle than my thigh pass strap, the wicketkeeper almost apologetically took the bales off to stump me. Being sporting, their captain stepped in. Have another go, lad. If we don't appeal, you're not out. It was very gracious, but my embarrassment only deepened when focus on getting a big step in. I somehow committed the same error. There was no reprieve this time, but on the bright side, we didn't have to feel for very long. We all got to go home early. That does sound humiliating, but I hope, Matthew, that you're... well, you've been able to process the shame, and I hope it hasn't put you off playing.
Well, Matthew, if it makes you feel any better, we had a guy called Johnny Killeen, who was Neil Killeen's son. Neil Killeen, who played for Durham, current bowling coach. His son was on the academy with us, and all winter he had done sessions week by week where he didn't know whether he wanted to bat right-handed or left-handed. That's how much he thought of his batting. He's a fast bowler. We came into a tight game against Hetton Lions, I believe, at the time. And Johnny had come out to bat as our number 11. And we thought there was absolutely no hope of winning this game. Now, the guy that doesn't know whether to bat right hand or left hand, he had both sets of pads, right and left handed pads, didn't know which end of the bat to hold. And he stepped forward as a right handed player with his right foot and hit a six straight down the ground to win the game. Unbelievable.
That's glorious. This next letter is from Anthony Smith, and it's on the subject of cricketers in petrol stations. Hello, Giles Mupp and Wark Mudd. Long-time listener, first-time messenger here. Reference your want for meeting cricketers in petrol stations. It was just the other week that my father bumped into the hero of Headingley, Benjamin Stokes, at Easington Services on the A19. My dad is someone that will talk to anyone about anything, and he caught the England, Durham and Northern Supercharger all-rounder while paying for his vending machine Costa Coffee. Instead of asking him about his appointment to the England captaincy or even his playing career, he decided to chat about the merits of current Glamorgan cricketer James Wheel, who played at our club, Stokesley CC. Keep up the good work and look forward to more. Well, I'm sure that the captain of the England cricket team is absolutely across everyone's form in the county championship right now. It doesn't seem unreasonable.
No, I think he'd have been fine to talk about. I think he'd have been really happy.
Oh, man, alive. Sorry, that has left me quite weak. By all means, actually, as an additional, I can tell you this now, I'll tell you the others at the end, as an additional letter subject for the mailbag. Hard-working cricket puns would be very delightful. Laboured cricket puns, we would love to hear from you on the subject. Now, this is correspondence from possibly my favourite of the cricket-playing nations that isn't England, Mark. Can you guess which one that is?
Because you covered them for BBC Cricket Scotland.
It's actually New Zealand correspondence. Hello, Miles and Mark. Sending this email from New Zealand to say thanks for the great entertainment. Love how you speak so glowingly of New Zealand. It brings a smile to my face each time. I think that's me he's talking about, Mark.
He must be the driver of the shark bus, is he?
Shark bus! I wanted to offer my contribution to cricketers spotted at a petrol station, or in my case, at an ATM opposite a McDonald's. Many moons ago, on a night out, I bumped into a mate in my hometown of Taupo after a provincial match between Midlands and Northland. He was a younger brother of an All Black and was showing Hamish Marshall, or was it James, around the local drinking establishments. He introduced us and we had a cordial conversation. Perhaps more notably, later that night, I bumped into them again. However, by this stage, I was unfortunately drunk off my tits and trying to recover my cash card from an ATM after it had been swallowed, having thrice butchered my PIN number. The means by which I was trying to recover it was by banging said ATM repeatedly with my shoe. It didn't work, and I can't quite recall whether the very pleasant Mr. Marshall laughed or looked at me disapprovingly, but hey-ho, it is what it is. Also on Drunken Nights Out, I've had a lengthy conversation with former New Zealand cricket commentator Brian Waddle and invited former All Blacks player and selector Earl Curtin around for breakfast. Thinking back, it was an odd request, and no wonder he didn't turn up. This reminds me somewhat ludicrously of a time many years, I think it was when my book Fib and the Heat came out, I had a sort of summer going to various literary festivals, and one of the people that I kept bumping into, because he had a book out the same year, was John McCarthy, who's now a friend of mine, but at the time I hadn't really met him before. He's a fascinating man, actually, very nice man. And I was with my friend Dougie Anderson, and we got very drunk. I was chatting to John McCarthy, and I said, "Do you know what, John? You and your family absolutely must come round for a barbecue sometime soon." And he went, "Oh, that sounds very nice." He went off to the loo, and I turned to Dougie and went, "Dougie, I don't have a barbecue." Absolute panic. I was very out of my depth, obviously. Now, here we go. This is a WWE update from Clive. Dear MPU team, Thank you for a brilliant podcast that brings joy and laughter with each episode. Our pleasure. Thank you, Clive. Father to last week's episode and Woody's suggestion his wrestling name would be Wonderwood, surely it would actually be Derek Wonderwood. That's now there is a cricket pun. That's excellent.
Yeah, that blows mine out the water.
Derek Wonderwood, very good. I tried to think of a signature wrestling move. Maybe he's deadly with his left arm on a drying canvas that's been left uncovered and has sawdust all over it. Okay, cricketers as WWE wrestlers, that could be a new category for mail. Do keep the mail coming in. Thank you for our letters this week, Matthew, Clive and Anthony and Chris. I mean, thanks everyone, for heaven's sake.
Hi, it's David Gower here. Yes, it's me. Look, it's slightly embarrassing, but look, Mark and Miles, they've forgotten the email address again. So look, if you've got any cricketing tales, stories, whatever it might be you want to send to them, please email them at middleplease@hotmail.com. And if that's too much, well, try Twitter or Instagram.
Now, we've got a guest on this episode of the podcast. We always have a guest, don't we, Mark?
We do, yes.
Yeah. Who do you think's been, not including today's, who do you think's been your favourite ever guest on Middle Please Umpire?
I mean, there's been so many good ones. I mean, if I had to pick one of me favourites, I think I quite like the Jimmy Adams one we did. Notorious D.I.G., you can't look past him. I mean, there's been loads. Simon Taufel was really good. Sam Mendes. I mean, we've had a few good ones, haven't we?
Well, I'm afraid the correct answer was Michael Atherton. Now it is time for this week's guest. I'm going to give you a few clues as to who he is, Mark.
Yeah.
Okay. Like you, he has played in a World Cup final. Any guesses so far?
Gordon Greenidge.
No, it's not Gordon Greenidge. But yeah, right sport. he's 6'5".
Oh, Big Bird.
No, always wore a light blue helmet, even when on England duty.
Oh, Angus Fraser.
No, it's Derek Pringle, you Middle Please Umpire is proud to be sponsored by Step One Underwear, the UK's choice for comfortable, breathable and no-chafe boxers. Step One believes great achievements start with getting the basics right. So delivering maximum comfort while you're compiling your century or coming in for your third spell of the day is all important. Step One's stylish boxers are worn by elite cricketers and sports people the world over. But why do they wear them? Well, they completely eliminate chafing with their ultra-glide panels, which prevent your thighs from rubbing together. So get rid of the baby powders, lotions, or whatever other remedy you use. They have got your thighs covered. Not only that, they're ethically made, sourced from sustainably grown organic bamboo, making them super soft, antibacterial, and breathable, keeping your, and I can't believe I'm saying this, meat and two veg dry all day, whether you're on the pitch or going about your other everyday shenanigans. It's not just gentlemen who get to enjoy the comfort of Step One, they have a women's boxer range as well. Step One are so confident that you'll love them that there's a 30-day money-back guarantee on your first purchase. If you don't like your first pair, for whatever reason, they will give you a full refund and you get to keep the pants. So you can try them out completely risk-free. Best of all, for a limited time, listeners of Middle Please Umpire, that's you, can get a whopping 30% off the entire range. Just head to step1.life and enter the code MP30 at checkout. See what the fuss is all about and make Step One an essential part of your daily chafe and sweat-free living. Step One, get some.
William Hill's Safer Gambling Tools helps you stay in control. You can set deposit limits, session reminders, and take timeouts whenever you need them. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly. William Hill is who you play with.
Well, we are joined now by our guest this episode. It's none other than Essex and England's, and indeed the world of journalism's, Derek Pringle. Hello, Derek.
Hello, Miles. Hello, Woody.
Hello, Derek. Good to have you on.
Yeah, cheers. Good to be here.
I was thinking there's a lot of things to talk about, I suppose, with you, Derek. Obviously, we could talk about your decade as a England player, or you know, the part you played in that sort of multi. Ridiculously successful Essex side, and indeed all your journalism. But I suppose really, when you talk about cricket, what is it that you want to be talking about?
When I talk about cricket, I think the thing that interests me most is Test cricket and long-form cricket. I mean, I just find the white ball game, there's some really thrilling moments in it, but I just find it all forgettable. I try and remember, where was that? What game was that? You know, etc. But Tests in red ball cricket linger longer.
As a player as well as a journalist?
Absolutely, yeah. I think, actually, in the early part of my career, I enjoyed, obviously, one-day cricket, and I felt probably that would be my way to playing international cricket for England, but that they picked me in the Test side when I was still at university, and it sort of rushed into it, really. So I thought one-day cricket would be the way in, but it proved that Test cricket was instead.
I was just looking at that scorecard of your first Test match today, and the idea of you being still at university and being picked is in itself a sort of terrifying thought in terms of pressure. You come into bat one place in the batting order below Derek Randall. I mean, how much pressure do you feel under? Yes, the two.
Two Derricks, doomed to failure.
But I mean, were you feeling the pressure at the time, or did you have the sort of the arrogance of youth to mean that it was actually all right?
No, I was definitely feeling pressure, but I suppose I sort of rationalised with myself that I'd played for the MCC a couple of weeks earlier against India at Lord's, and I think that's really what got me picked. Everyone thought it was my form at Cambridge that year, which was pretty good. But I think it was that game because I got four wickets and bowled pretty well. And I think that's what got me picked. So I thought, well, if I can do it in that game, why can't I do it in a Test match? So, and funnily enough, I got a wicket in my first over. But it all started well, but I didn't do very well with the bat.
I thought it was meant to be here. I mean, in those days, if you were playing, say, Mark, you'll have played against sort of Oxford and Cambridge and more recent times, but in those days, Derek, playing for Cambridge, I mean, would you have had a right to feel close to playing for? You'd obviously already played for Essex, but would you have felt you had a right to be close to the England Test side? Really, did that seem an enormous leap, or in terms of standard?
Yeah. I mean, it seemed pretty unlikely, and of course, the irony is, I think that had Keith Fletcher, my captain at Essex, remained England captain instead of being sacked after the winter tour, and then Bob Willis being installed, I would never have been within 100 miles of that England team. So it just shows you, because, you know, he knew his onions, Fletch, and he knew what I could do. And it wasn't probably, you know, good enough to get for England. But I think they wanted to shake things up a little bit. And Willis, at that stage, was a fan. And, I think things went well for me that season. And Peter May, Bob Willis, they thought, well, why not? But it did surprise me, there's no doubt.
What did you think of Bob Willis, firstly, the bloke, and then, because obviously on punditry, he plays this role. We actually got a chance to meet Bob as bowlers, and he sat us all down. I couldn't believe his passion for English cricket and how much he like backed us. But then in the punditry side, he played this character that was sort of, I'll have you in the docks and all that kind of stuff, which just didn't seem like him at all when you met him in person.
No, well, he was a great guy and a very fine fast bowler. Obviously, what happens, he became captain, and then the pressures of that job take their toll, and you just change a little bit. And in the end, I think he became a bit more miserable, which wasn't him to start with, certainly. And then I guess, you know, your relationship with him changes a bit once they're captain. It has to. So.
Yeah. He had great hair as well, didn't he?
He certainly did in the early days, yeah.
Do you know what? He came to see a play I was in a few years ago. It's just a small theatre, the Park Theatre in Finsbury Park, and the writer had got very excited. He sort of came into my dressing room and pretty much took the door off the hinges. He was very laid back a lot of the time, going, oh, apparently David Tennant's in tonight, or apparently, you know, whoever it is. And then one night he took the door off the hinge about 5 minutes before I was doing on stage. He goes, Bob Willis is out there. And that's all I could think about during the thing. It was just a one-man play, so you get a lot of time on stage and your thoughts going everywhere. But his silhouette, I was surprised by how recognisable it was in the total darkness. I was like, that's where Bob Willis is sitting. I can see it. I'm the only person on the podcast today that hasn't played in a World Cup final, so don't I feel a bit of a Charlie. I've got such vivid recollections of you playing in the whole of that tournament, actually. You bowled the last over of their innings for just two runs off it, and they'd been on an absolute blitz, hadn't they? I mean, Inzamam
didn't go for many, but there were a few, I think, leg-side wides in it, because obviously I was trying to cramp them for room, and it was just missing the pad, and the umpire's very keen to wide those in those days. Well, still are. Yeah, I suppose in those days, slower ball was something relatively novel. And I used to bowl quite a few of them. And I think they had a swish at a few slow balls and missed them. So that helped, obviously, keep the runs down.
Because in the modern day, obviously, it's so much white ball cricket now. Do you feel, although your obsession, personal obsession, is red ball, that you would have been at home in the white ball game of today, even if in your heart of hearts you thought, I don't like this as much as the other, do you not think that your skill set would have been very well suited to it?
Well, that World Cup you just mentioned, I mean, those white balls, for me, swung all over the place. I was very keen. And once you get, I think, I always say, if you get the ball moving sideways, they're not going to smack it out of the park all the time. Nobody can do that. I don't care how good you are. But the white balls today, and I feel for Woody and fellow bowlers, they don't seem to do anything. And the pitch is obviously prepared to suit batsmen completely. So it's
right, Derek, you're absolutely right. They bring the boundaries in, the bats are bigger. I mean, it's
they do,
yeah. Really.
Totally against the bowlers. I mean, everyone says cricket should be a balance between bat and ball. In white ball cricket, I don't sense that.
And I'm hopping about a bit, but this your passion for red ball cricket then, at this particular moment in time, I should explain, we're now at the point where England have got a new test coach. Obviously, the managing director was announced a week or so ago, but we feel like we're at a sort of crossroads. What do you feel it needs to happen, and what do you feel will happen to the red ball game in Britain in the next, say, 24 months?
Well, I think the modern world is geared up to enjoying success. So if England can become extremely successful again, I think that'll give it a good boost. There's a couple of interesting appointments. I think what I've seen of Brendan McCullum and what I know of him, and that's only come from being a journalist, and I never bowled at him, thankfully, is that he's a very dynamic player, but a very laid-back personality off the field. I mean, some of his press conferences when he was New Zealand captain, you know, had all this kind of folksy wisdom. So it's going to be interesting, Woody. You're listening to a few of his talks. Let's see how you get on.
No, I'm actually really excited. Very excited. Like you say, he's got this like laid-back, bigger picture perspective on life kind of thing. Or it seems that way. But plays hard on the field, so I think it'll be interesting, that first team talk. I'm not sure which way, if it's the laid back one or if it's the dynamic hard playing cricketer that will come out first.
See, what's interesting, Woody, what would you look to get out of a coach? Because, you know, when I played, we didn't have a coach at Essex. And then for England, Mickey Stewart was the coach. And he didn't really interfere very much. He'd throw you a few balls and what have you, maybe have a quick chat if you thought you were doing something wrong, and that was it. What do you look to get out of a coach, an international coach?
Yeah, I think, you know, the man management side of things is really important. Good communication, honesty, a sense of probably trust, I would say, as well.
Can you have that? If he's a selector, can you have that? Trust?
It's a tough one, but I feel like if you have a certain amount of trust and respect and a good communication with the coach, it makes it a lot easier when those decisions don't go your way, there's no mixed match. Or
when I first saw his name mentioned, I obviously didn't read the piece very properly, because I thought, well, that'd be for the white ball team. But then they said, oh no, it's a test team. And I thought, well, actually, that could be an interesting experiment.
Instinctively, that would have been my response. But maybe Brendan McCullum, I don't know if this has been said about Brendan McCullum before, he has a touch of the Derek Pringles about him, and his real passion is... His real passion is the red ball game.
Don't tell him that.
Yeah. I think him and Stokesy together looks great on paper, doesn't it? Like when you see McCullum and Stokes, head coach, captain, that anybody, any opposition team would look at that and think, they'll give a good test, these lads. So hopefully they can bring the best out of everyone else.
Well, as a bowler yourself, Mark, I'm sure you don't want to play as many shots as those two probably want people to play, because you need a bit of a break.
Yeah, exactly. A break
when you've done a bit of hard yak. You need them to occupy the crease for a day and a half.
Exactly.
Would you say you were in a team more as a bowler than a batter, Derek? I know you're in the all-rounder bracket, but bowling, I think we could probably both agree, is your strongest suit. What is it like, those moments where, so like Headingley 91, where you are, you know, where that extraordinary Gooch century, you come out to bat with England, you know, six wickets down for not many. What is the thing that clicks in your mind that enables you to do a job like the job that you did that day? You put on, what, 98, the two of you?
That's right, yeah.
Against a terrifying attack. Ambrose Walsh. Listen to this, Woody. Ambrose Walsh, Patterson and Marshall. That is who Derek Pringle's spending
out. Read, I went further up the lakeside here on camera.
Yeah.
I just started creeping lakeside a little bit.
We were fortunate. It was a very cold period, not just a cold day, a cold few days there, and the pitch was slow. That was in our favour. But just to rewind slightly, when I started sort of thinking about professional cricket, I wanted to be, you know, a batting all-rounder, to be honest, because, you know, school and university, I batted up the order. And Essex gave me a chance. Actually, I used to bat six of them. And in fact, as you say, I batted just below Derek Round on my debut.
That's not at all bad, is it?
I think people thought I could bat a bit, but, you know, things get to you and the bowling takes over a little bit, and I drifted down the order a little bit. But, no, I felt I could handle myself with a bat. And I just thought, you know, Gooch is playing so well, just have to stick in. It doesn't matter how many I score, as long as, you know, we're two at the crease, he can score the runs, et cetera, et cetera. And on this pitch, it just, you know, nibbled around a bit. I think I thought we felt if we got 200-odd ahead, we had a good chance.
But also, if you're 6 foot five, aren't you? Is that right? 6'5", something like that?
6'5", yeah.
So if you get a what they call a good stride in, I mean, that's... How far down the pitch is that going? Absolutely miles.
I wasn't getting a good stride in against those guys.
Oh, it's the clap miles.
So if I was facing that sort of attack, I'd try and play them all late, right under my nose, and I think probably extremely late.
Well, that's the way to play it. That's the way to play it, Headingley, in those days against whoever, because it did, as I say, it did nibble around a bit, especially if it was cloudy. And yeah, play it late and don't go for the big drive.
And then at the end of a game like that, though, that you know. There's been that sort of backs against the wall moment for England to win that game, take a lead in the series, and you to get to the end of the game knowing that you've played, you know, maybe not the headline role, which goes to Gooch, but you've played an absolutely vital role. Surely that's just a glorious feeling.
Well, yeah, it's a satisfactory feeling. You feel very satisfied. But what impressed me more is getting Viv Richards out in the first innings, actually, because... I bowled a Jaffa at him and he nicked it and Lanalam dropped it. And I thought, oh, God, we're not going to get another chance. And then the very next morning, that was just before they had a play on day one. And the very next morning, it bounced again just outside of Stumpy, nicked it again. And this time, Lammy clung on. So I thought, oh, well, not too much damage done. So whenever you got him out, that sort of meant more in a way, because he's a sensational batsman.
To the point where, I mean, would he be one of the people that when you'd be at the top of your mark, you'd actually be slightly frightened, really, as a bowler? I mean, normally you're in a position to sort of get the wood over someone. But in that situation, there must have been some people in that era, I mean, some astonishing flair players as well, hitting the ball unusually hard for the time.
Well, they were very aggressive batsmen the West Indies had. I mean, people forget. I mean, everyone, you know, bigs up the Ashes. But in that era, they were the team to beat because they were easily the best team in the world and reigned supreme for 15 years. But I think early in my career, yes, you feel a bit nervous when you're about to bowl to Viv Richards. But, you know, I was, in 1991, I was getting on a bit then. I thought, well, you know, no point in getting nervous. It's just a waste of energy.
How many more wickets would you have had with DRS?
I reckon a few, Woody.
You'd have certainly had more in the World Cup final.
Dickie Bird was a hard man to please. But, I mean, it's interesting because... you know, I played the three Ashes tests in Australia and, you know, Mark just bowled absolutely brilliantly in the last Ashes series and, you know, deserved many more wickets. And, you know, for the way you bowled, Mark, I thought it was great. You really shoved it up the Aussies and I always love to see that. But on the tour I was on, if you didn't get the batsman on the back foot, they'd never give you an LBW. And of course, at my pace, I didn't force them on the back foot. They'd never give you an LBW.
In your book, which I remember speaking to you about it, I, the way it's, you know, how accessible it makes the game and the dressing room feel to the non-playing fan, shall I call myself? But there's in terms of like the difference between the eras in which Mark is playing and you, that in which you played. The sort of standout bit for me is you all, I think, is it Boxing Day, walking out on the MCG, all absolutely hanging. That to me, that's a sort of difference between the generations. That seems absolutely astonishing.
I think they're
better
than we did.
Well, we won actually. So there are... somehow, but I think it'd be the same for both teams. Both teams would have had a good Christmas party, no doubt about it.
I was doing a lunch thing in at Christmas, and Mike Gatting came over. It was a taverner's lunch. Mike Gatting came over to chat to me and another performer, Tim Key, and we were talking about the difference in eras, and I was saying, oh, that stuff in Derek Pringle's book about those days, and he was going, well, those parties were incredible. And Tim said to Mike Gatting, who was it that always used to dress as a he said, who was it that always used to dress up as a woman at those parties? And Mike Gatting, without dropping a beat, said, Phil De Freitas, Diana Ross, gorgeous. And it was one of the most, we sort of let it pass. It was one of the most extraordinary bits of conversation I'd ever had. But there seemed to be no side to it. It seemed to be a very sincere and heartfelt comment.
Well, Chris Terray, in the year I was 82-3, Chris Terray dressed as Ina Sharples, I believe.
Because those parties, there was that tour, wasn't there? I think it was Atherton, but the England players and the press lot sort of fell out slightly, and they didn't accept the invitation.
The press always used to get an invite to the pre-dinner drinks, and in those days the relations were pretty good, and that all stopped with Atherton's tour to when he was captain to Zimbabwe, when things weren't going to plan. And they decided, we're not having those tossers in here. And they dropped us off the itinerary.
And that's because had you already got your costume ready? Was it a bitter disappointment?
I don't think people did it then, because you can't, downtown Harare hasn't got many theatre wardrobes. You can go and get the costume.
It's not you, Self and Fraser going as the Supremes or what have you.
Fraser was probably on the edge of the England team then, cursing he hadn't been picked. He wasn't in the press gallery by then.
Actually, on the subject of Angus Fraser, have you ever, to your knowledge, Derek, been mistaken?
You're famous on this podcast, Derek.
Have you ever been, to your knowledge or recollection, been mistaken for Angus Fraser?
Often, and he for me.
Because we had somebody sent in a letter saying, describing me, they were a big fan of Gus Fraser, and they'd seen him on one of the outgrounds, and they chased him across the pitch. They were absolutely desperate to meet him. By the time they caught up with him, he was sitting in the marquee behind his laptop, and they said, "Hi, all I want, Angus, is to, all I want is to get your autograph." And the man sitting behind the laptop said, "I'm Derek Pringle, you." Is that?
I perhaps wouldn't have used the C word.
Yeah.
No, it happens all the time, and it happened to him as well. He's been mistaken for me, and he goes, "I don't wear glasses,"
Because I suppose the two of you, I went in 2006. I did that thing when I went to India pretending to be the BBC Scotland cricket correspondent, and I got into the press box to try and grab a place, and I think the first two people I encountered in there, from my recollection, were you and Gus Fraser, who, of course, not only was I intimidated by the fact that you're former international players and real journalists, but the fact that your combined height was terrifying. And I remember spending, I was away for a month with you.
Was
lot.
That Nagpur?
That was at Nagpur, the first one. That was.
Yeah. He does remember your miles, see?
He remembers the ground. Cook, Panesar, and Blackwell, and Panesar. Yeah. But I remember being absolutely terrified.
And
it was Jupp's debut in the press box. Yeah, but I just remember being and I hadn't expected it, I guess. But I was just so intimidated by the sort of former players, and those, of course, all of those of you that were sort of bowlers and whatever, had this sort of slightly intimidating. To me, a slightly sort of intimidating aura. And I remember Fraser going, "It sounds to me like you're on a bit of a jolly." And I was going, no, I'm working very hard. Of your era then, who were the bowlers that you found yourself sort of envying? Obviously, there's batsmen you don't want to be sending the ball down to, but when you looked around the national, from international players, but also when you were part of that Essex side, people like Lever obviously are absolutely extraordinary, but playing around the county championship, and you'd played a lot of games in those days, who were the people that you would sort of watch on thinking, God, imagine being able to bowl like that?
Well, J.K. Lever was a fantastic bowler, but he was left arm and had such a long run that I think I'd have played two games and had to retire. you know, if we didn't have a very creative scorer, we'd have been shelling out for over 8 fines, you know, throughout our careers. But we had a good scorer who managed to somehow get it all back. Our slow over 8. But J.K. had an enormous run, but a brilliant bloke and a great guy. I mean, obviously, you know, I used to look at Joel Garner and marvel, but I couldn't be like him because he was 6'8". I was only 6'5".
And he was only 6'5".
How does that feel, little Mark Wood?
You know? He was
an incredible bowler because so accurate and decent licks, you know, 86 miles an hour, 87 miles an hour with a toe-crushing Yorker that he just never seemed to miss. You know, he just hit that block hole all the time. Malcolm Marshall was a fantastic athlete. I mean, probably the greatest overseas player to play in the game in England because, you know, he never took a day off. He steamed in every time he played for Hampshire, which not all the other overseas players ever did, the overseas bowlers ever did, but Marshall always tried 100%.
So I was listening to you talking on another podcast and you were talking about how just, I suppose, his level of skill, his ability to bowl so fast at the beginning of the spell, but also the fact that he really, you know, made such good use of the old ball as well and had almost... You know, it was two different types of bowlers, really. The out and out pace bowler at the top of the, you know, with a new ball, and someone that just had excellent
early
swing.
He was always quick. I mean, you know, like Marcus, they don't have it's six gears or nothing. But then, obviously, as he got older, he just became a more skillful bowler. I don't know whether he deliberately cut his pace a little bit, only a little bit, but you know, he didn't quite bowl quite the lick he did early on in his career. Same with Ambrose, actually. When I played Ambrose his first year in Test cricket in 88, and he was rapido. But, you know, he then played county, got the county grind, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, suddenly it's a yard, a little bit, probably a yard slower.
I suppose, do you think Wantage Road's not the most inspiring... of the sort of coliseums in which he
wasn't
applied
then.
His trade.
It's not a bad ground now, though. I mean, it's along with Chelmsford, it's my closest county ground, so I go and watch a bit of cricket there. I saw Yorkshire there, as I say. But unfortunately, my old home ground at Chelmsford is very tatty at the moment. It needs to be spruced up a bit.
Which players have you been wowed at being a journalist? So never mind playing, like after getting a different view of things, which players have you been wowed at since you've been a cricket journalist?
Right, throughout. I mean, you know, Ben Stokes is a fantastic player to watch. Brian Lara. I only played one game against Lara in the 92 World Cup. So I was leaving the game when he was just starting. So I've watched him as a journalist. Sensational. And you know, Shane Warne, obviously. People like that. You know, some of the greats of the game, really. Very, very, very fortunate to be a journalist when I was.
I bet he still tries to work people out. I bet he thinks, if I was bowling at him, this is what I would do, this is his technique. He'll definitely still think like that, definitely.
Absolutely right, yeah. I mean, if you see a batsman do certain things, you think, yes, well, I'd try and do that maybe, yeah, whatever.
I mean, how would you bowl to Mark Wood, for instance?
Oh, God. Full and straight, thanks very much.
I put a couple out on a slog.
Yeah,
he knows me well.
Yeah, six slips, two mid wickets.
Woody's a good striker of the ball. I tell you, he should take his batting a bit more seriously. I think he could add to that single Test 50 you got, Woody.
Yeah, Collie keeps saying the same thing. Really. He keeps getting me trying to work me harder on my batting and try and play a bit more correctly. So keep trying.
Yeah, why not?
Well. Those that brace of sixes that you hit in the Ashes, I think they'll...
That's the problem. I've gone from like first and second gear to eighth gear and I can't get out of it. I just can't stop playing shots. I need to like rein it in a bit.
You need to go back and watch footage of Derek Pringle at Headingley against the West Indies. That's more what you can't keep watching yourself.
Does he have trouble sleeping, Woody, then?
That sort of like towards the end of your play, 92 then, say, there's that Pakistan side that you skittle in the early stages of the World Cup. They then win the World Cup final, which turned on, some might say, the LBW that...
He's let it go, Miles. He's let it go.
He's let it go. I should. You're right. I should learn from this.
There were two in one over. They were both dead.
Absolutely. So in DRS, that would have been a very different result.
Well, I don't know, because Imran top scored. I mean, Jarvi would have been out cheaply, and they'd have been under enormous pressure because they'd have been three down for about 20. But you know, Imran still got runs. I think in the end, they bowled really well. They had a good bowling attack, so that'd put us under pressure, whatever.
People like Wasim and Wacker coming in, did that feel like the game changing?
Well, Wasim, I played against him in 1984, so that's 8 years before that. So, sorry, 85. That was when he first appeared on the scene, and again, he was extremely quick. Probably didn't have quite the skills he had later on, but, I mean, you know, you talk about that 92 summer. You know, just talking about myself, fancying myself a little bit with the bat, I scored in binary that series. Zeros and ones, because if you didn't bat in the top three and they got the ball for reverse swinging, you had no chance, because those two guys bowling high licks with the ball moving late in the air. I mean, you know, routinely that summer we'd be 180 for three, all out 220.
Yeah.
That's how it went.
And the photographs of everyone looking getting out looked the same. It was always just, you know...
Well, at the Oval, Wesley Macker got me out twice with reverse swingers, one from round the wicket, one from over the wicket. And I remember going off just in time to see the first one, which was over the wicket, and thinking, how did he play that? Because it just looked like a gimme leg stump half volley, which he clipped through mid wicket and it took my off pole out.
Yeah.
And I got off, and when Atherton obviously had the luxury of facing the new ball, which didn't do anything. It went straight, but quick. Obviously, they were still fine bowlers, but it didn't swing like it was then. And he scored 70, and he said, "Oh, you just missed a half volley." And I said, "You're joking." Anyway, he was adamant that was the case. I just missed a half volley. But then Wasim wrote a book, and in the book, he referred to those two dismissals, saying they were two of the best balls he ever bowled. So,
wow.
Touché.
Well, he chose his moment.
Many years later.
I think of those successive deliveries in the World Cup final when you got like Lamb and Lewis. Were they the two in succession? They looked absolutely unplayable.
I think as well. His action must have been hard, because not just what he did. The ball itself was obviously amazing, like how he'd work, but the way he skips through the crease, his arm would be over before you even know it. Like, it looks like his action would be difficult to pick up.
Yeah, he had a very fast arm. You're right, and he ran in fast as well. It was all like, you know, quick. And yeah. it did take you by surprise, but he was one of the best that's been, I think. Oh, where's him?
So what are your best memories of the game, both, well, this is two questions, on the pitch and indeed off the pitch? I can't believe there wasn't some fun to be had. But what's your purely on the pitch memory, what's your greatest memory of your career?
Well, it's tricky, because I think I had so many really good ones with Essex. They were, you know, I think I say in my book, you know, thank my lucky stars that I played for them. I think that Headingley Test match would have been, you know, because West Indies, we hadn't beaten West Indies in England for about 23 years at that stage. Not a single test. So to beat them was, you know, a big deal.
And what about off the field? Maybe harder to choose.
Off the field, I think that's quite easy, really.
Nagpur 2006. You went to the test box.
There was a sweating man who looked very confused.
it's the name dropping moment when we played Worcestershire just after Ian Botham had joined them, and Eric Clapton was staying with him, and it pissed down with the rain all of the Saturday, so there was hardly any play. Eric cleaned up at cards, which a few of the Essex boys were involved in, and well, I don't know what about 400 quid was in the pot. And then he said, "I'll tell you what, lads, I'll play for you in Beefy's pub if I can buy a certain amplifier in the local guitar shop," because Beefy's got one of my guitars in his boot of his car, which he did have. And so we all repaired to Beefy's local, and he plugged in and played for us. Essex team, and not all of the Worcester team turned up. Actually, they're obviously too used to these stars turning up.
Why does he keep booking Clapton?
Serenading them.
Yeah. what was on the set list?
He did a version of Layla, Wonderful Tonight and all that stuff. And then I remember I'd just seen it's probably a few years before that, Edge of Darkness. Do you remember that thriller with Bob Peck in it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And anyway, he did the music for that, and I said, give us a few licks of that, and he started playing it. It was brilliant.
Just did it. Treating him as a jukebox. That sounds extraordinary.
And it was very, very friendly and very welcoming, and it was great. And then word obviously got round, and the locals started piling in, and he pulled the plug. He said, sorry, I was just here to play for my friends. Didn't get out too well.
Sorry, you have to have played first-class cricket to listen to me in this particular venue.
Indeed.
Mark, do you know about Derek Pringle's film career?
No.
Oh, Derek Pringle is in one of the most successful British movies of all time.
Oscar-winning movie.
Oscar-winning, the British Academy.
What kind of role does he play?
I play the...
An athlete.
Vice captain of athletics.
This is in the film Chariots of Fire. I think that... Is Stephen Fry in it as well as a kind of undergraduate that's an extra?
He is indeed. As I always brag, I was on screen for longer than Stephen Fry. Me and my mate who were in it, we never thought it would amount to much. So when it won an Oscar, we couldn't believe it.
Before we get to Woody's super over, would you say that the England strip for the 92 World Cup campaign, is that the best England one-day kit ever, Derek?
I was told somewhere, I don't know if it's true, that it was Jimmy Ennis's favourite shirt, but I don't know if that's true.
No, I think it is the best one. We tried to replicate it a little bit in the 2019. That was sort of to replicate the 92 one. Obviously not identical, but it was to replicate that. And yeah, 92 one's the best.
92, that seemed glorious. That would be when New Zealand had only just stopped playing in sort of their one-day strip was a kind of light brown... they looked like they went to a sort of slightly baffling prep school.
Well, they had grey as well at one stage, I think. Grey and a sort of horrible tan brown, yeah.
Very, very distressing. Woody, is it time for Mark Wood's Super Over?
I think it is. Can you be on the clock then, Miles?
I can.
Should we explain to Derek what's going to happen?
I think that would be polite.
Derek, we're going to ask you a series of quick-fire questions. You have to say the first thing that comes to your mind. Miles is going to be on the time for 90 seconds. Can you do this? Derek Pringle, yes or no?
Yes.
The essential thing I always think is don't think, speak.
Right.
Sort of the opposite of life, really. On your marks, get set, go.
White spikes or coloured spikes?
White spikes.
Your favourite TV owl?
Don't know any.
Any celebrity contacts in your phone, or who is the best celebrity contact in your phone?
Michael Atherton.
Wow.
first cricket bat?
HV Odd, Clapham.
Favourite sandwich filling?
Sausage and mustard and tomato sauce.
Turning pitch or green top?
Green top.
Heaviest item ever dropped on your foot?
A 10 kilogram dumbbell.
Have you ever been mistaken for a famous person or another cricketer?
Yes!
Mike Gatting is coming for dinner. What are you going to cook him?
Roast cauliflower.
And you walk out the back, what are you going to ask the umpire for when taking guard?
Two legs.
Oh! By the barest of all margins. Within the time there, Maz?
You had 3 seconds left over because Derek did it as was asked of him.
Quick fire.
I mean, the Atherton one's incorrect because I think Beefy would probably trump him, and Beefy is in my phone as well. So.
No. Let's stick with Michael Atherton because
stick with it. Yeah, sure.
Oh,
and to answer it quickly, an A comes before B. Yeah.
What was the bat name you said? HV Odd?
I think it was HV Odd. I remember my dad used to, because I was brought up in Kenya, and he was a very keen cricketer himself, and he played, he qualified to be a horticulturalist at Kew Gardens. And, you know, he played for Kew, etc. And he swore by this guy who made bats in Clapham, and I'm pretty sure his name was H.V. Odd. I remember him coming and buying me a junior-sized bat from this guy. So I thought H.M. Odd or H.V. Odd.
And a very good sandwich choice there, sausage and mustard. That's very grown up.
Again, it's a throwback from a secondary school in Kenya that I went to. And the only thing you could get in a tuck shop was a hot dog. Not a sausage, unfortunately. The hot dogs are pretty horrible. But this woman, she used to say plain, she's Polish, plain, mustard, tomato, or Mary. And Mary was a mixture of tomato and mustard. No, that's where I'd go for it. But if I said sausage with Mary, you wouldn't have understood that.
We'd have all sorts of images would have flashed in our minds. And what, in terms of imagery, what would be the likely result of feeding a roast cauliflower to Mike Gatting? What would be the immediate social and biological fallout?
Yeah, good question. I mean, Gat likes trough, but you know, I've got a couple of roast cauliflower dishes that are delicious, so I think he'd go for it.
Well, Derek, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on Middle Please Umpire. You have you already had legendary status in my
calling someone a
thanks so much for coming on, Derek Pringle.
Thank you.
Derek Pringle Derek Pringle is one of quite a few people we've had on this series who I feel genuinely sort of starstruck by, because it's that when I got into cricket, which was 91, you know, he would have been one of those people when I first started watching cricket and listening to cricket, you know, was one of those figures that, you know, that following England in that 91-2 World Cup, you know, it was just extraordinary. I remember being so heartbroken by the losing.
I still feel like they should have won that 92 World Cup, shouldn't they? I don't know. Obviously, they came across a team that played well, but I still feel like we should have won that one, 92. Great outfit.
You were born...
We had the best clothing, didn't we? I've watched it back. I was born in 1990, but I've seen the games and the clips. It's mad to
see. It was fantastic.
Neil Fairbrother and stuff then, and... You know, he looked ahead of his time and as a one-day cricketer. And I thought we had a good side.
That was the team that, you know, the first England team that existed for me. So to be on the end of a Zoom call with Derek Pringle is frankly glorious.
How about when he said about, when he was talking about Joe Garner being only, he was 6'8". Oh, he's massive, 6'8". And he's only 6'5". Only 6'5".
Yeah, I think, no, you did look a bit chastened by the very thought of that, I must say. So that is it for this episode of Middle Please Umpire. Our guest, to whom we are very grateful, was the great Derek Pringle. Thank you very much from me. Goodbye.
And goodbye from me, Mark Wood.
Oh, should be taken and is taken. Brilliant from Mark Wood. What a spell this has been.
Every day, William Hill has advanced odds on cricket matches. That includes flash odds ahead of the big games, plus hashtag your odds and much more. Stake limits apply. Odds may fluctuate. Visit williamhill.com, 18+. Please gamble responsibly. William Hill, it's who you play with.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.